This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
By the book on BFM 89.9.
Not very long after, she had a daughter with a skin as white as snow, lips as red as blood, and hair as black as ebony. And she was named Snow White. And when she was born, the queen died. After a year had gone by, the king took another wife, a beautiful woman but proud and overbearing, and she could not bear to be surpassed in beauty by anyone. She had a magic looking glass, and she used to stand before it and look in it and say, "Looking glass upon the wall, who is fairest of us all?" And the looking glass would answer, "You are fairest of them all." And she was contented, for she knew that the looking glass spoke the truth. Now Snow White was growing prettier and prettier, and when she was 7 years old, she was as beautiful as day, far more so than the queen herself. So one day, when the queen went to her mirror and said, "Looking glass upon the wall, who is fairest of us all?" it answered, "Queen, you are full fair, 'tis true, but Snow White fairer is than you."
Hello, you are listening to Buy the Book with me, Lee Chui Lin, and my fellow lover of fairy tales, Shamila Ganesan. And together we are joined by a special guest actually calling in from the United States. We have Professor Maria Tata, who is a professor of folklore and mythology, both of which we plan to cover today, as well as Professor Tata's latest book, which is The Fairest of Them All, Snow White and 21 Tales of Mothers and Daughters. Professor, thank you very much for joining us.
Great to be with you today.
So I just wanted to start with, to start at the beginning, so to speak, because you have spoken in other interviews of how at the beginning of your academic career, fairy tales weren't necessarily regarded as an important or perhaps even valid area of research. And we're seeing this change over the years. So what do you think is actually driving the growing interest in these stories?
Oh, that's a fascinating question. And I ask myself that every day because you see fairy tales proliferating in our culture. And I think part of it is a need to get back to ancestral wisdom. What were the stories that were told in campfires, around firesides, you know, just in households and in workplaces to make time pass? And we want to get back to that foundation in a way. Toni Morrison calls it the foundation of the ancestor. And listening to that voice is important because it helps us try to figure out where we're going, how to navigate our future. And also it helps us think about all the great what ifs. What if the most terrible thing you can imagine actually occurred? What would you do and how would you survive it?
Now, we're both huge fans of fairy tales and mythology, which is what really drew us to wanting to speak to you in the first place. You know, many of us encounter these stories as children, but we were wondering what first interested you in exploring folklore fairy tales. What was it about it that caught you?
Well, it was really, in many ways, the cognitive dissonance, if I can use that term, between what we think of as fairy tales, what you just described, stories for children, and then the discovery that, in fact, these were part of an adult culture. The shock of reading to my children the juniper tree, unwittingly reading it and discovering that a stepmother chops up her stepson and serves him up in a stew to the father. And we're back to what we were talking about earlier, the primal and the mythical. Your imagination is running wild. So it was that conflict between what we think of these stories and what in fact is there in the probably the non-Disney versions, but even the Disney versions are pretty scary. So that was really what drove me to try to explore the function of these stories. What cultural work do they do for us?
And we are about to talk about your book, which focuses on the central question, I suppose, or the central idea surrounding Snow White and what informs that. But I did want to also touch on the fact that different fairy tales seem to attract more attention at different points. Sometimes it's driven by movies being released or by Disney deciding that this is the one that they want to focus on, and other times not. So what do you think determines why there are peaks and valleys of people wanting to retell or re-engage with different stories, you know, Beauty and the Beast, Cinderella, Little Mermaid?
That's a fascinating question. I think that it's really overdetermined. So there are multiple factors. If we take the story of Snow White, what is driving that? I mean, it's a story about mother-daughter conflict, a timeless kind of thing, all the complications in the mother-daughter conflict. And it's also about aging, beauty, aging, and regeneration, or new generations replacing the old. I think part of what is driving the interest in Snow White has to do with a phenomenon in the U.S. that we call cougars. I don't know whether you're familiar.
Yeah.
You seem to know that. Yeah, these glamorous middle-aged women who are in a kind of competition with younger women. So our culture constantly changes or stages these beauty contests among women. You can go back to the Trojan War, which started with a beauty contest, and then up to Snow White, and then the Kardashians, this series in which you also get that conflict between mother and daughters, those sort of beauty contests played out again and again. The royal family, another great example of it. So all of those factors, I think, are driving the interest in Snow White, which is also a tale about narcissism and duplicity and deceit and how you can manage to conquer that wicked queen who is oppressing you and taking you out into the woods and threatening your life.
So that sort of ties in very neatly with your latest book, The Fairest of Them All, which kind of, I suppose, explores those themes in different cultures and different variations. What made you want to focus on Snow White in the first place?
I think that I trace it back to seeing the Disney film, not as a child, not for the first time as a child, but when I went to see it with my five-year-old daughter, who loved the Wicked Queen, this charismatic figure. I mean, she is not the fairest of them all. She's the foulest of them all. And I couldn't understand, you know, this attraction for this figure of evil, this cruel woman who does all of these terrible things, abandons the girl in the woods, sends the huntsman after her to kill her, but then also has this great underground lair. She's a master of magic and transformation. She has all of these beautiful volumes, dusty volumes, in her lair underground. And, you know, there are ravens and skulls. So she is a source of fascination and also the center of knowledge. And, you know, if you think about it, if you've seen the Disney film recently, you'll recall that Snow White is just as insipid a character as you can imagine. That is a voice that I remember from my childhood, older women speaking like that. So that way that these stories are culturally inflected is fascinating to me. That is, you even hear the film came out in 1937, but you hear women's voices of the 40s and 50s and 60s in Snow White.
And, you know, the book kind of looks to explore the way Snow White or the way the themes of Snow White, I think, permeate through different stories from around the world, from different cultures. What was it like seeking out these other, perhaps lesser known stories? I mean, what was the process of that?
There's a tremendous archive that can be found because anthropologists, also missionaries, I'm a for better or for worse, collected these stories in the 19th century with, I want to put it as missionary zeal. They were determined to try to get inside the heads of the natives in a way. And what better way to do it than to listen to the stories that were told often at sunset with multi-generational audiences, is listening in. And then to me, the fascinating fact that, you know, I discovered that there were African tales, not about Snow White, but about a girl who is called the beautiful girl, And again, this tale really turns on beauty, about a beautiful girl. And you can go to almost any culture in the world and find a sort of Snow White story. I want to rename it The Beautiful Girl, stories about beautiful girls. And they're deadly, deadly, scary, cruel mothers or stepmothers. Sometimes in Japan, the person, the figure we know as the stepmother is called the second wife. So it's a slightly different twist. And it's one of the few tales in which the two are reconciled in the end. So a beautiful story about how it doesn't have to have this terrible ending with the wicked queen dancing to her death in red hot iron shoes, as is the case with the Grimms, or in the Disney version, she falls over, she's pushed over a cliff more or less, or pursued by the dwarfs, and then tumbles down this terrible cliff.
Now, in terms of these different versions of these stories, the ways in which they have taken root and evolved in different places and different cultures, are there particular links that can be made between how the story has evolved with the traditions and mores of that particular culture?
With that, well, certainly, I think that each version of the story tells us a great deal about exactly what is going on in the culture, but it also tells us a lot about the audience for the tale in a certain time and place. I was shocked to discover that in Switzerland, which we think of as a country of peace, there's a very short version of Snow White. And I don't think I'll be spoiling the ending because this can be read in 5 minutes. But in this tale, Snow White is taken in by the seven dwarfs, and an old woman comes knocking on the door, asks for hospitality. She's turned away. And what happens? But she recruits a hitman in the village to kill the dwarves. Somehow Snow White manages to escape. We don't know how, but she does. And you know, there's no real happily, well, I guess there's a triumph of the old woman. So it's kind of an unexpected twist. So I think each story has to be looked at in the context of the circle of storytellers, the time and the place. And there are weird little quirks. You know, for example, if a fairy tale hero is having dinner in Italy, it will always be noodles. And in Germany, it'll be Sauerbraten or something like that. And, you know, I mean, those are sort of trivial, banal variations. But it's fascinating to me to look at each version and to try to figure out, you know, what is idiosyncratic in this story and what is culturally symptomatic? What tells us something about why this story was told in this particular way?
Joining us today, all the way from the United States, is Professor Maria Tatar, who is a professor of folklore and mythology, which is why we've been focusing on that, as well as on her latest book, The Fairest of Them All, Snow White and 21 Tales of Mothers and Daughters. Are you fond of fairy tales, and are you fond perhaps of their darker roots? You can let us know by WhatsApping 018-789-8899, and you can, of course, also tweet us at BFM Radio. Keep it here on By the Book, BFM 89.9.
Be free-minded. BFM 89.9.
I'm awfully sorry. I didn't mean to frighten you. But you don't know what I've been through. And all because I was afraid. I'm so ashamed of the fuss I've made. What do you do when things go wrong? Oh, you sing a song.
Hello, you are listening to By the Book with Lynn and Shamila, and today our guest, Professor Maria Tatar, who teaches folklore and mythology, both of which we're examining, as well as discussing Snow White because of Professor Tatar's latest book, which is The Fairest of Them All, Snow White and 21 Tales of Mothers and Daughters. And I did want to touch on the fact that there are some elements that fairy and folk tales, regardless of where they're from, seem to share at their core. And you spoke about this earlier, about that sense of, use the word primal. And, you know, I think about things like quests and sibling rivalries, sexual rivalries, evil stepmothers or second wives, whichever they may be. Where do you think these similarities stem from? Or why do different cultures seem to share certain preoccupations? Where does that stem from?
Well, in the academy at universities in the U.S., we don't like to talk about timeless universals anymore. And Joseph Campbell is persona non grata in many ways, because he thought about archetypes and, you know, he went all over the world studying the folklore of many different countries, learning the languages too. So I'm a huge admirer in that way. And, you know, he found these recurring features. Now, it seems to me that if you go back to a story like Little Red Riding Hood, this very simple tale, and if you try to unpack it, you realize that it's filled with all kinds of complex issues. But the basic one is the nature-culture divide, our relationship to the natural world. That is, what about those beasts out in the forest? Who is the predator and who is the prey? So that's something that you can find everywhere. It will haunt us in different ways, though, because that beastly predator, that wolf in the forest, has now turned into a sexual predator in the 20th, 21st century. Actually, starting with Perrault, even in the 17th century, who recognized that the most dangerous wolves were really the ones without furry pelts. So men could be dangerous and seductive, and in some cases, deadly. So he warned little girls that they should be afraid, they should be fearful. So the nature-culture divide, and then of course, many of these stories take place in the family unit, which is the source of all kinds of rivalries, which are magnified, amplified, and enlarged in the fairy tale. Again, getting back to this, what if you hated your sister so much that you tried to kill her or something like that? And the fairy tale gives you this safe, symbolic place to play out some of those enlarged fears and to find that, you know, you can find a place, you can somehow discharge some of those emotions or get past them and find a happily ever after. So, you know, just one more example, maybe Beauty and the Beast, which is about hostility and hospitality, compassion, feeling something for the other, no matter how beastly he or she may look.
Now, when it comes to the Snow White stories or versions of the Snow White stories, were there any in particular that you found that surprised you? And also on that note, do you have any examples that might resonate particularly with our part of the world? You mentioned Japan earlier, but I was also wondering about other Asian or Southeast Asian versions.
Oh, yes. Well, I love Princess Aubergine, and it's a story. I think that the version that I collected was told in a border region, I think of Pakistan and Afghanistan, but it's a tale that is disseminated widely. And what's interesting about that one is this necklace which plays a pivotal role in it, and the, you know, trying to get hold of the necklace. And the fact that in that particular story, the daughter actually takes an active role and manages to plot and connive as cleverly as the stepmother. So there's a kind of tango that is being danced there. So it's not just passive daughter and active evil queen.
You mentioned earlier that fairy tales or mythology, folk tales, in some ways they give us the extreme versions or the extreme answers or spaces to explore that question of what if, right? But I also think that a lot of the fairy tales that perhaps we are most familiar with or that we grew up with are sanitized or moralized. So that safe space always ends in some way with a, but if you're a good girl, then, you know, none of this will happen and it's all fine. And so I just wondered whether you had any thoughts on that, how the Disneyfication of it might have affected the way that they're read and understood.
We can go back to the 17th century and Charles Perrault, who retold many of our favorite fairy tales, Little Red Riding Hood, Sleeping Beauty. And what did he do at the end of each story? He added a moral. And, you know, as you, with Little Red Riding Hood, it's don't stray from the path. And then he added a second moral about wolves with furry pelts. And the Grimms then took up that tale and really transformed it into a story for children. Little Red Riding Hood actually internalizes the lesson and says at the end, "Oh, I will never stray from the path." Well, if you think about it, it's not really a story about straying from the path. It's a story about wolves in the forest, and you might stay on the path, but still encounter the wolf. So there's often a disconnect between moral and the actual story, which I think is what gets us talking. Now, what you said is so fascinating to me, because a few weeks ago, I read the story. I started reading Hansel and Gretel to my five-year-old granddaughter, and I was shocked. I found myself constantly editing a story that I had loved as a child, a story that was my favorite fairy tale because of the sibling solidarity in it, not the rivalry, but the solidarity. It was full of all kinds of terrible things. I mean, beginning with the parents who plot, you hear all about how they're plotting at night to abandon the children. The children overhear them. And they try to counter by pulling these tricks, but they fail. And there they are in the woods. The cannibalistic witch who lures them into her cottage with sweets and candy and then, you know, plots to have them for dinner. Do I really want to read that to a five-year-old? Not today. And I used to feel, oh, no, you shouldn't edit. You shouldn't talk. But you should. Tell the story in a way that is appropriate for the child. Some kids love the violence, the scary stuff. Some kids are really terrified of it and will have nightmares. So we have to kind of adjust and calibrate. And this is why we have this wonderful cultural repetition compulsion about fairy tales. And getting back to your earlier question about, you know, why we fix on certain, why we settle on certain fairy tales, it has to do with our need to rescript certain stories and to tell it in a different way and to make the fairy tale our own, because they were never written in granite. They were never meant to be in print, really. It's great that we have those stories in print because we know what X, Y, or Z was telling in a certain time and place. But when it comes to entertainment, we should, you know, just feel that we can remix, adapt, we can do whatever we want with the story.
So speaking of exactly that subverting or remixing or adapting, one thing that we've been seeing a lot of is writers, particularly feminist writers, reclaiming and subverting some of these tropes and characters from classic fairy tales. What do you make of this approach?
Oh, it's extraordinary. Starting with Anne Sexton in the 1970s, writing this book of poetry called Transformations, in which he starts out with a grim story, retells it, just, you know, not giving broad strokes more or less, and then gives us her version of it, which is often, you know, her way of living the fairy tale. It becomes existential and just as horrifying as some of the tales in the Grimm's collection. And then Angela Carter and Margaret Atwood and Toni Morrison, who takes African-American folklore and weaves it into novels like Song of Solomon and also a novel called Tar Baby, which reconfigures the Tar Baby story. These great collections that, you know, sort of take the fairy tale, reverse roles, set the story in the present, give us the point of view of the villain, and make it often up close and personal. It's astonishing how many of these adaptations are written in the first person. And the fairy tale, as you know, is always, it's traditionally been told in the third person, without a great deal of access to interiority, to what is going on in the mind of the character. We know that Hansel and Gretel are feeling sad because they sit down and cry, but we don't learn about how they're actually feeling.
So as we're approaching the end of our chat, I wanted to go back to something you mentioned at the start, which was the cognitive dissonance being the thing that caught you on fairy tales that made you realize, hold on, you know, what is it that I'm reading? What was the first fairy tale that you remember being read or you remember reading? And I suppose, you know, did it surprise you even then?
I think the first one, I'm going to come back to Hansel and Gretel, which my sister read to me. We had a book of fairy tales, Grimm's fairy tales, in German. Neither of us knew German, but the book had pictures, so she told me these stories. And I, well, not for actually coming back to Snow White, I remember the frontispiece was an image of Snow White in the coffin, and I was captivated in this transparent glass coffin with the dwarves worshiping beside her. And then my sister telling me the story, and again, I've talked about sibling solidarity and the way that these two really get through a terrible situation and find their way back home.
So what are you hoping that people will take away from Fairest of Them All?
I think the power of storytelling, the fact that, again, we have stories that bind us. I like to think of folklore. I think it was Arthur Huff Fawcett who described it as a golden network that connects all of us. And I think that it's important, you know, to talk back to, say, the Disney fairy tale, the corporate fairy tale, which is sometimes, you know, fascinating and gets us talking, gets the conversation going, but which is a kind of top-down fairy tale. And I think by showing how there's so many different versions of the beautiful girl, of the story that we know as Snow White, we discover there's actually a bottom-up version of the fairy tale. And as much as there's tremendous cultural variation and all the things we talked about earlier, there's something there that gets us all talking and that allows us to talk to each other across cultures.
We've been talking about Snow White, but are there other fairy tales that you see potential in for this sort of exploration? And, you know, is that maybe in the works?
Bluebeard, I think, which is one of my, I don't know whether I should call it a favorite fairy tale, but probably one of the most fascinating, because it's a story about female curiosity. Curiosity always gets women in trouble, but it also always saves them in some way. And it is what makes a heroine, I think, in a curiosity and care, empathy. And Bluebeard's wife has that curiosity, and but she's faced with a husband who has a past, not only a past, but a chamber with the corpses of all of his previous wives. So how is she going to get out of this situation? How will she rescue herself? And in many of the older versions that were recorded, it takes brothers or someone from outside to save her. But in many of the newer versions, she's able to develop a strategy. She's able to use her wits, her brains, her smarts to find a way out and to discover a path to happily ever after.
Professor, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Great to talk with you.
You just heard Professor Maria Tata, who teaches folklore and mythology and recently published, among other works, The Fairest of Them All, Snow White and 21 Tales of Mothers and Daughters. Tell us about your experiences with fairy tales. Are you even now, as we speak, rethinking them? WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio. And of course, you can also write to us at buythebook@bfm.my. Brings us to footnotes. And I'm just going to get this out of the way. We sound a little bit different. We spoke with Maria a couple of weeks ago now. And, you know, accounting for the time difference, we had to do that call at home. But now we are back in the studio, which is why, you know, hopefully the sound quality is better.
I hope so. But I'm sure people are also really used to us sounding all sorts of ways in this new normal.
Yes. All right. So since we spent so much of the interview discussing Snow White, discussing this idea of fairy tales and the way they inform our world, the way female characters are intertwined in that, we also wanted to take the opportunity to observe the International Day of the Girl Child, which just passed on October 11th, actually, and talk about books or stories that really center exactly that,
a child who is a girl.
Yes. And, you know, I think that there are actually a lot of books written with girls in mind. And we promised each other we wouldn't talk about Anne of Green Gables because we talk about her too much. But, I mean, I think those are great examples. And in some ways, I think it's because of the intimacy of a book versus movies, or, you know, of which there haven't been too many great female characters that we can look to. When I think of the female characters that inspired me as a child, most of them are from books.
Yes, I agree. And a lot of them are actually from children's books. I've spoken before about my fondness for bad girls, so to speak, or for unlikable girl characters such as Harriet the Spy. I also wanted to bring up, I'm not going to talk about them in detail, but I wanted to bring up Pippi Longstocking as well as Heidi. So, you know, for the longest time, I wanted to be Heidi, you know, to live on the hills, to sleep under the eaves.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I agree. There is a sense of intimacy. I think there is also, if you are a child who, like many others, grow up playing with things like Barbies, there can be a real pleasure in reading books that give you permission to be different from that, to find other ways to be feminine.
Yes, I think the characters that you were talking about actually reminded me of two of my favorite characters, both from Enid Blyton books. One is, of course, George from Famous Five. Georgina, but who calls her Georgina? George. And also Lotta from the Mr. Galliano Circus series.
Which, I loved Lotta.
And those two girls, you know, I don't know what George grew up to be, but I'm going to call them girls. But I was going to say that they both are exactly what you just said. They don't fit the mold of the good girl. They don't do things that make... They get upset in the books. They get angry. They have tempers. And whether the book then eventually frames them as being naughty or not, I think Enid Blyton did a great job of giving these not-so-good girl characters a lot of empathy. And I think that mattered a lot to me as a child.
So you are going to be talking, I think, about a book that is also to do with childhood. So I'll start then, because the book that I wanted to talk about is actually an adult novel, and it is True Grit, which has been made into, I don't know, three movies now. The original with John Wayne, a sequel, and then perhaps the one that most of us know better from 2010, I believe. But True Grit, the novel, is a 1968 book by Charles Portis. It was actually first published as a serial, and that kind of makes sense because it's an adventure story. And the girl in question is Mattie Ross, who is the narrator and is looking back. She's described as a intelligent spinster, you know, basically the cool woman of her town. And she's looking back at this incident in her childhood when she wanted to avenge her father and she wanted to get a U.S. Marshal to help hunt down the man who had killed her dad. And that's basically it. And it's about the idea of whether or not she has true grit. And she does. She is such a marvelous character. She walks to the beat of her own drum. And she is somebody who, despite the men in the story increasingly trying to cut her out, even though she's the one who brought them all together, she refuses to let that happen. The amount of agency and personality in this character is just so immense. So, yeah.
Mr. Dogburn?
What is it?
I'd like to talk to you a minute.
What is it?
They tell me you're a man with true grit.
What do you want, girl? Speak up at supper time.
Let me do this. Your makings are too dry. I'm looking for the man who shot and killed my father, Frank Ross, in front of the Monarch boarding house. The man's name is Tom Chaney. They say he's over in Indian territory, and I need somebody to go after him.
What's your name, girl?
My name is Mattie Ross. We're located in Yale County. My mother's at home looking after my sister Victoria and my brother little Frank.
Best go home to them. They will need help with the journey.
There is a fugitive warrant out for Chaney. Government will pay you $2 for bringing him in, plus 10 cents a mile for each of you. On top of that, I will pay you a $50 reward.
I haven't read True Grit, but I love the movies. I love the John Wayne original. I love the Coen Brothers remake. And I particularly love the interpretation of Mattie in the newer one, played by Hailee Steinfeld. And she's exactly what all of the things you just said, right? And that I love that contrast of the True Grit referring both to the Marshal and her. And in many ways, juxtaposing her on the same platform as him. And I think for a male writer of that era to write a book like that is really impressive. I didn't even realize it was actually a book until after I'd watched the film.
It's a very enjoyable read. It's incredibly well written. It is, if I may borrow a phrase that I think is appropriate for this, it's a real yarn. You know, so I would recommend it. I love it.
Well, speaking of men who wrote really great girl characters, it's quite interesting that we both picked something along those lines, I think. I was going to bring up Matilda by one of my favorite children's books authors, Roald Dahl.
It is bad enough when parents treat ordinary children as though they were scabs and bunions, but it becomes somehow a lot worse when the child in question is extraordinary. And by that I mean sensitive and brilliant. Matilda was both of these things, but above all, she was brilliant. Her mind was so nimble, and she was so quick to learn that her ability should have been obvious even to the most half-witted of parents. But Mr. and Mrs. Wormwood were both so gormless and so wrapped up in their own silly little lives that they failed to notice anything unusual about their daughter. To tell the truth, I doubt they would have noticed had she crawled into the house with a broken leg. Matilda's brother, Michael, was a perfectly normal boy. But the sister, as I said, was something to make your eyes pop. By the age of 1.5, her speech was perfect, and she knew as many words as most grown-ups. The parents, instead of applauding her, called her a noisy chatterbox and told her sharply that small girls should be seen and not heard. By the time she was 3, Matilda had taught herself to read by studying newspapers and magazines that lay around the house. At the age of 4, she could read fast and well, and she naturally began hankering after books. The only book in the whole of this enlightened household was something called Easy Cooking, belonging to her mother, and when she had read this from cover to cover and had learnt all the recipes by heart, she decided she wanted something more interesting.
I mean, if you don't know the story of Matilda, it's about a very, very gifted girl who loves reading, who is in a family of people who are, well, parents who are just awful and not very intelligent and resent her for being intelligent.
I would think it's fair to call them anti-intellectual, actually.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it sort of takes us along on a journey of how she learns to, I think, use the best parts of herself to make the life for herself that she wants. I don't want to give too much away if you haven't read it. It's such a great book for any girl growing up. But there's so much in there as well. There's so much about agency. There's so much about the power of imagination, about reading, about positive female role models. So I think that, if, you know, in terms of...
You're talking about Miss Trunchbull.
Well, yes, but no, Miss Honey. And Miss Honey herself has that great track of how it was like for her to grow up under an abusive household. So there's so much in that book that, you know, for a seemingly simple children's book, it's actually something that stands up really, really well even today.
Yeah, I agree with you in not wanting to spoil things, because the first time I read that story, I could feel my heart drop,
yes,
you know, at certain moments and race at others. So yeah, absolutely. So outside of fairy tales then, and recognizing that we're plucking just 2 examples of what could be a wide and long list, we're talking today about the International Day of the Girl Child and celebrating that with Roald Dahl's Matilda and Charles Portis's True Grit. Let us know if you have favourites of your own in this category of books that feature girls. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio, and write to us at buythebook@bfm.my.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.